It's 9 p.m. in the East, 8 p.m. in the Central United States, 7 o'clock in the mountains. At KSAV, it's 6 p.m.
You open this door with the click of a mouse. Beyond it is a world of sound, thought, and opinion. In-depth discussions of television's greatest blending of science, superstition, imagination. And you're invited along. For the next 30 minutes, we'll be talking Twilight Zone.
And right you are, Dave. We're going to be talking Twilight Zone once again. I'm looking around in here, and the room has filled up. I'm outnumbered, so I'll introduce our host, Bob, and Bob can introduce the group. Good evening, Bob.
Thanks, Dan. Hello, everybody, and welcome to this, the latest edition of Talking Twilight Zone. The usual suspects are here with me this evening, but with one addition to our panel. First, welcome back to Kitty, who we trust enjoyed her very well-earned and well-deserved vacation. Kitty, I hate to say this, but we missed you so much that as soon as you walked out the door, we immediately hired a replacement. Well, not really, because nobody could possibly replace you. We made an addition. Lynn Carpenter, who has called in before and sent us emails as well, is also here. Beginning tonight, she's a permanent group member. That makes us a nice round number of four, two men and two women, for whatever that is worth. This evening, we are at episode number 8, every successful TV series dating back to when Lucy and Ricky had a baby has that one episode that everyone has either seen or thinks he has seen because he's heard about it so much. You mention the title of the series and they say, oh yeah, isn't that the show where that strange little man with the funny glasses was the last person left alive after a nuclear war? And you say, yeah, that's the one. The title is Time Enough at Last. And we don't just invite people to be on this program and just sit here, only I'm allowed to do that. So here is our new permanent panelist, Lynn, with a summary of this most memorable episode. Lynn?
Okay, Bobby, thanks. I'm happy to now be a permanent part of this great show and great team. Thank you so much, Bob, Kitty, Ken, for your support. Thanks so much. Well, let's get right down to business here. Is there any Twilight Zone episode that resonates in the hearts and minds of Twilight Zone lovers and aficionados as much as the incredibly unforgettable and truly moving episode called Time Enough at Last? It stars the amazingly wonderful actor Burgess Meredith, who went on to be a major player in three of Rod Serling's subsequent Zone episodes. This man could touch your heart and make you feel for him like no other actor in any of Rod's stories. However, you never felt more for him than in this particular episode. It was his first Zone appearance, and Burgess played a meek and mild-mannered man named Henry Bemis with a kind heart who wants nothing more than enjoy his passion for the written word. Nobody in his life can understand his love of reading, and all of the most important people in his life are against him. His wife is a shrew who won't even let him read the newspaper when he comes home from work at night. Isn't that what most men did in that time period when they came home from work each night before the dawn of the internet? And she was horrendous enough to scribble all over the pages of his favorite poetry book while pretending she wanted him to read to her from it. His own boss thinks his wife is a brilliant woman for not allowing him to read. I'm sorry, but Henry was a very patient and kind person. I don't agree that he should have been reading while doing his job as a bank teller, and he made mistakes with his customers because of it. However, he couldn't read any other time except when he went down to the bank vault during his lunch breaks, which is exactly what saved him from a nuclear explosion that detonated the world around him. At first, he was scared and confused, but then he began to relish the solitude. He had plenty of food, but God knows how long Henry or the food would survive because of the radiation. That was not an issue in this episode, though. After a few days, Henry realized that the solitude was too lonely for him. He even tried to find his nasty wife, Helen, once he realized what had happened. Now, that's desperation. He considered suicide. However, just before he pulled the trigger of the gun he held to his head, a gun he found by accident in a destroyed sporting goods shop, he saw a library just a few feet ahead of him, and all the books were intact. He was thrilled. Finally, he could read as much as he wanted for as long as he wanted, with no grief whatsoever. Finally, there was time enough at last. What a dream come true for Henry Bemis. Until he sits on the library steps, reaches for a book, slips off the steps, and his Coke bottle glasses fall from his face and break to pieces. One of the saddest and most heartbreaking shows ever in television history. I'm sure there were very few people who watched this episode without tears in their eyes at the end when Henry yells out, "That's not fair! That's not fair at all! There was time now! There was time!" How many people were screaming no at their TV sets? Poor, poor Henry. A totally classic television viewing event to this day. Also, very few people could help but love Burgess Meredith as Rocky Balboa's trainer in the Rocky movies. What can I say? The man was extraordinary. Just about everything this man did was extraordinary. This was a television episode for the ages and will most likely go down in history as one of the most memorable and beloved television episodes of all time. In fact, TV Guide rated the 100 most memorable TV episodes of all time this past June, and Time Enough at Last was rated at number 11. I know it's my all-time favorite zone. Totally classic. Enough said. Over to you, Kitty.
Okay. Well, that was a pretty good summary you did there. I don't know what all I can add to it other than...
Well, thank you.
Other than this is certainly one of the ones that sticks out for me. When I think of Twilight Zone, this is definitely one of the many that stick out for me as a really good episode. And I remember the very first time I saw it, I was in my teens, and I was watching it at my dad's house with my stepbrother, and the ending just took me completely by surprise when the glasses fell and broke, and at the end I'm going, "That is so sad." And I remember my stepbrother Curtis turned to me and said, "Well, they all are pretty sad." He says, "That's the Twilight Zone." Is everybody there?
I'm here.
Okay. I heard a click. Sorry.
Yeah, I did too.
Considering, though, that he had such a horrible life prior to this happening, his wife treats him horrendously. I mean, when you think about all the other awful things a husband could be doing, and his, and the only thing she can find wrong with her husband is that he reads too much. I mean, how many women out there would complain about a husband who reads? So, I think it's a very well done episode, and I certainly would rate it as a classic. And I agree, Burgess Meredith is a terrific actor. The first time I ever saw him in anything was when I was a very small child, and he was the Penguin in the old Batman series on TV. But more recently, I thought he was fabulous in, before he died, he actually played Jack Lemmon's father in the funny movie Grumpy Old Men, and he kind of stole that movie a little bit with his eccentricity playing a 90-year-old father there. But this is an excellent episode, and I really don't have any complaints about it on any level. I think it delivers on all points.
I forgot about his Penguin episode. His Penguin, movie.
Oh yeah, not in the movie, but on the regular TV show.
Oh, that's right, the old Batman series.
Yeah, the
right.
Old Batman show.
That's right.
So,
okay, let's get Ken's view on this.
Okay, girls, you did a great job. I think the whole key to any television, either show or episode or series, is to engage the audience. And if you, if the writer can do the job, the director, the you know, the whole scene, the whole, you know, the first act and the second act, if you can keep your audience interested, then you've done your job. And obviously, Rod Serling, he wrote this episode, and I like the placement of the episode because it comes early in the series, and this is truly a classic. I agree with you guys. It's in my top 10 of the best of I've seen of all television shows. This has to be in the top 10. As far as the Twilight Zone series itself, I have one other that I rated higher above it. Actually, maybe a couple more. So I'll let you know on our top 10 when we write our books where this one comes in.
But, how dare you?
I'll keep everybody in suspense there. But I agree. The first act sets up the scene with Bemis. You know, the scene in the bank and then the scene with his wife. I like the way Rod Serling had the contrast between the husband and the wife. The husband is kind of a, you know, he's small in stature, he's kind of quirky, he's got those glasses, and then the wife, she's tall. You know, it's kind of like a tall and a short scenario, and she's grumpy and kind of actually just a real hag, if that's the right word. I don't know what the, a nag, that would be
no,
the right,
right
word. She's just a nag, and I obviously, as a husband, I would not want to live with her. Boy. But anyways, and then he goes into the vault, and then the nuclear bomb. Okay, so as the audience, we're engaged. We care about Bemis, what's going to happen. And then the whole props, the whole set in the second half, with the, you know, you actually felt it was a nuclear explosion. You know, you have all the buildings down, the car, the sofa, everything's a mess. And then that library scene, you know, they had the steps and all the books all over the place. And then, you know, Bemis' reaction, oh, the books, and you just feel for him. And right away, you know, Bemis is in heaven. And it's an emotional scene. And he puts all books together, he stacks them up. And then out of nowhere, and obviously I don't know how many people guessed it, maybe out of a million people watching, I would say if you're a smart person, maybe one or two people on this planet would have guessed the ending, but I didn't. It had me fooled. He breaks his glasses, and right away, the whole scene shifts from heaven, and all of a sudden, it's hell. You know, oh my God, what is he going to do? Nobody's around? You know, there's nobody there? He can't read his books? What's he going to do? And then Serling comes on, and then the fade of the scene into the night. I mean, how much better can this get, you know? So, Bob, go ahead if you got some time in the first half here.
All righty. Well, we really don't. We're just about up against the break. Let me just say that I agree with everything that was said, but I want to get just a little bit deeper into this episode when we come back after the break about television in 1959 compared to what it is now, because everybody says that it was a sad ending to this story. I say it was something different. It was a cruel ending to this story.
Yeah.
A very, very cruel ending to the story.
Very cruel.
And that's very, very unusual to see in television. Not so much today, but it was back then. Sponsors did not want to make the audience unhappy. And one thing is for sure, when you come away from this story, you are unhappy. Time for a break. When we come back, we will continue.
Okay, Bob, we'll be back with more Talking Twilight Zone here on Sheravision Radio.
Hi everyone, Susan McCrae, host of Getting to Know You. On my next show, singer-songwriter Larry White. He's one of the top talents in the music business, arranging, conducting, and performing for film, Broadway, TV. So tune in Tuesday, 6:30 p.m. Pacific, 9:30 p.m. Eastern, right here on KSAV.org, your Sheravision Radio Network. We're in the air, everywhere.
And back we go for part two of Talking Twilight Zone. Here's Bob.
Thank you, Dan. Beginning on our next program on September 8th, we will start reviewing two episodes on each show, one in each half. except for those which are considered to be classics, which will get their own programs. First up on September the 8th, a frantic man visits a psychiatrist with exactly the opposite problem that the late Michael Jackson had. He can sleep all right. The only problem is, if he does, he won't ever wake up again. Richard Conte co-stars in Perchance to Dream. In our second half, Nehemiah Persoff portrays a man who finds himself on a ship during World War II. He seems to be the only one on it who knows that it's about to be attacked by a German sub, mainly because he's the one who attacked it in Judgment Night. 2 weeks from tonight on Talking Twilight Zone. Back to Time Enough at Last. A few words about the star of the show here, Burgess Meredith. Burgess Meredith was 52 years old when he made this particular episode. He would, as Kitty has already pointed out, continue to work till the end of his life. He lived to be 89 years old. He was just slightly short of his 90th birthday when he finally died. But his appearance in The Twilight Zone was a comeback of some sorts, because over his career he actually had 175 different parts on television, almost 200. And but in the 50s, he was caught up in the communist witch hunts, and he was considered to be a hostile witness when, like so many other people, he refused to name names. He was practically drummed out of the business, and his career nearly ended. So coming back this way and coming back in a story that resonated like this did wonders for his career. There's no question about that, and it would continue for many, many years afterwards. This story really appeals to me for a lot of reasons, and many of them already stated, but for a few more that mean something to me. I don't like long, convoluted stories that are padded out. And what you see on TV today is nothing but that. Try to find a half an hour drama on TV today. I dare you. You can't find anything. Why? Because they want to cram as many commercials as they can in. So everything is an hour long, and the whole middle of everything, even when it's a decent story, is so boring you can't even stay awake. That wasn't that way back when they made this story. This is a very, very tight story on a very, very fast track. It wastes no time. And it's a good thing, because in order for the end of the story to work, you have to be on Henry Bemis' side. You have to like him, and he's not terribly likable. It starts out, he's a weaselly little man. He's got a funny voice. He's wearing thick glasses. He's one-dimensional. He cares about nothing but reading. Personally, I wouldn't want to be stuck in a room with him, and he's not the most appealing man in the world. So we might look at him and go, who cares about this silly little man? Well, we have to care about him right away. There's no time in this episode to tell his life story or anything. So what do you, I mean, the story is based on a written story by a woman that ran six pages. So Serling had to adapt it for TV and flesh it out a little bit, but he really doesn't have any time. So what do you do in order to get the audience on his side, on Bemis' side? If you can't say anything positive about him, you make the people around him even worse than he is. And it starts out right away. It starts out right away with his customer in the bank, a woman who's giving him a hard time because he misplaces a dollar. Then his boss comes along and humiliates him right out on the bank floor, humiliating him in front of everybody. Then he goes home, and of course he's married to the bitch of the century. So right there, right along, by that time that any of that has happened, and that's in the first part of the story, we're already on his side, and it's necessary for that to happen in order to feel the way we do at the end. I said before the break that, in my opinion, it's not just a touching and emotional ending to the story. It's a very, very cruel ending to the story. It's almost as though you're watching a story about a kid after school, and a group of bullies comes along, and they beat him up, and they throw him around just for the hell of it. And when he's totally defeated at the end of it, the head bully comes over and sees his glasses on the ground, and he grinds them into the ground. He steps on them to make him feel even worse. That's really, really a cruel story. How unusual is this? Well, in 1959, when television was less than really 10 years old as far as networks were concerned, sponsors were very concerned about that. If you're watching it and you are made to feel bad when it's over, what are you going to do? You're going to take it out on. Well, you take it out on the sponsor. They're convinced of that. You won't buy their product. So it surprises me to see this terribly, terribly cruel ending. While you're watching it, the natural thing you see is, oh, okay, so the world has come to an end. Bemis is going to die anyway because he's already eaten food and done everything imaginable that is wrong. And so at least for the last few days of his life, I'm not even sure it would go that long, maybe a day or two, he'll get to sit there and read, and the world will come to an end, and that will be that. Instead, he ends up falling on his own glasses. That's an extremely cruel ending and most unusual for that to happen. That makes it different than anything you might see today. Of course, television today tries to offend everybody every hour, so they don't really care as much as they did back then. But that's a very unusual story to have it be that way. Now, the other thing, I want to put a question out here to everybody, and that is about halfway through the second part of the story. Bemis looks around and finally comes to the conclusion that nobody is alive. He's the only one left. And he says, well, at least I'm alive. And then he looks around and goes, the question is, do I really want to be alive? Now, ever since nuclear bombs were invented and used to end World War II, we have lived with this kind of insanity, and everybody understands that if you use them, surely everybody's going to die. I don't agree with that. I went on the Internet today, and there are 70 billion people in the world. And it is ridiculous to imagine that everybody would die in a nuclear war. Not right away, because it's between us and the Soviet Union. All of us live on either coast in big cities, so we're all doomed. But people who live at the opposite ends of the world, and tribes and forests, and people who, like in the jungle, have no idea what's going on. They probably will survive, at least for a while. So my question is Henry Bemis right when he says, do I really want to be alive? And if, heaven forbid, it ever happened to you and you were in his position, would you rather be one of the victims rather than be alive? Everybody's dead. Everybody you ever cared about is dead. All your loved ones are dead. The world is destroyed. You surely don't want to be around. Let's start with Ken. Ken, how do you feel about that?
Hard to say. You know, you have to put yourself in Bemis's shoes, and you have to say, how would I react? I probably would react the same way Bemis would, where you're moping around, you know, you go from place to place to place. You know, I was wondering, what other kind of ending could you have had to the story? Could his wife just pop up out of the rubble and send Henry?
That's even more cruel than what they did.
Yeah, I was going to say that would have been worse.
I agree.
Wouldn't that have been a happy ending? And that may not have worked. So I would say I would probably feel the same way as Bemis, and I would, you know, mope around for a week. It would be hard to get transportation, like you said, if there's people alive. How are you going to get to another side of the city or the town or the state? How are you going to get there if the cars aren't working, no bikes, no planes, no trains?
So you would rather be one of the victims than just die in the war?
No, I would rather stay alive and then just
see what
the plight is.
Really?
Yeah, I like, you know, Bemis took the gun. You know, to me, I would never take the gun. I would rough it out.
Lynn, how do you feel about that? Do you want to be a victim or do you want to survive this?
You know, that is a very tough question. I don't mind solitude. I actually don't mind solitude. But, you know, being without any other person in your life, anybody around to talk to deal with, or, you know, even have any kind of interaction with, I don't know if I could handle that. I mean, I like solitude. I'm a very quiet person that stays to themselves, but you know, I don't know if I would like to be the only person on earth, and maybe I would want to kill myself. Maybe I would.
Kelly, Kitty, how do you feel about that?
Oh, I think I'd want to be a victim and just get vaporized up front.
There you go.
I am not somebody who would do well living in the instant stone ages.
No, I agree.
You know, I like my modern conveniences and everything, and you know, because it's not just everybody you lose, but you've basically lost your life as you know it. You know, you cannot get on the bus and go to work anymore. There is no such thing as a microwave oven anymore that you can warm your food up in. There's no Starbucks down the street that you can go get your latte
from. Well, there's radiation everywhere. You can just sit the food out and it'll cook.
Well, eventually the food and Henry were going to evaporate from the radiation. So,
I don't think I'd want to go through radiation sickness.
Yeah. No.
Let me just say this, that the Twilight Zone, because it began in 1959 and ran until 1964, is right in the middle of a great deal of nuclear paranoia in this country. I know better than anybody, I'm the oldest one here, regrettably, and I was just getting ready to go into junior high school in 1959 when this episode played on TV. I was already hooked into the series. And so I'm one of those kids who was marched out into the hallway to duck and cover and sit there doing air raid drills just in case there was a nuclear war. It was absolutely ridiculous. Of course, I wasn't going to protect anybody. And so I was very uptight about that. I don't know about the other kids, but that made me nervous. I didn't like it one bit. I didn't like what I was reading and seeing on TV. It was a very tough time to be around, and it all culminated in 62 with the Cuban Missile Crisis, in which the world almost did blow itself up. So that was that. I think that this, for many people, especially my age, this really resonates for that reason, because you think back to it, to that kind of time, and it really is a very real-life kind of thing. And the fear that I had from day to day to day about that happening was all of a sudden on a TV screen. Now I was not only faced with having to worry about it, but to consider whether or not it would be worse to actually survive. My parents wouldn't be around, my house wouldn't be around, nothing would be around anymore. And I think that's part of what makes this episode work. Now, this is the first bout between the Twilight Zone and what I call nuclear paranoia, but it's not the last. There will be other episodes in the Twilight Zone during the rest of this run that are memorable also regarding nuclear war and the possibility of it. Even stories that don't have to do specifically with nuclear war. We see astronauts in the future traveling to other planets, and they say, oh, yes, that was 200 years ago, back before the great nuclear war that destroyed the world. So you really had to be there in 1959 to understand that this kind of thing, this particular episode, really plays perfectly into that kind of thing.
Yeah.
There was a lot of talk about it.
I agree.
And so that's why I think everybody remembers it. That and the acting and the story. But I go back to what I said at the beginning. I agree. Probably TV Guide has it a little too high. I would put it higher than that. I would put it in the top 10.
I would have too. I was very disappointed that they put it
in
number 11.
But it is terribly, terribly mean-spirited. It's really a very cruel story. It's difficult to watch because everybody likes a happy ending. Now, there's no happy ending here. But it would have been, you know, that final scene with the camera pulls back and he's on the library steps. If he could just have been reading, we would have said, well, at least he got that. But he didn't even get that. So actually, fall on your glasses at the end is a shock. To be honest, I would be shocked if I saw that on TV today, in which almost anything goes. But to see that in 1959 was really quite amazing. And Burgess Meredith plays it perfectly. He says the one thing that would have been on everybody's mind, which is that it's not fair. And that's true.
It really isn't
fair. He didn't do anything to anybody. He didn't deserve that.
Can I ask one last question?
Sure. We got about 2 seconds. Go ahead.
Okay. How the hell did Henry and Helen get together? I mean, I don't get it. I mean, she had to know that he had this passion for reading before she met him. And maybe didn't bring his book to her.
I got to interrupt because we're up against the clock. All I know is, if you're married to her, you'd be better off being in a nuclear war. That's the show for today. We'll be back in 2 weeks.
Probably was.
Thanks to everybody. We'll be back in 2 weeks.
Okay, Bob, thank you. And we'll see everybody 2 weeks from tonight for more Talking Twilight Zone. Thank you.
Thank you.